All right, hey, you guys, happy April Fool's Day. And, you know, I just found it so funny this year that Easter would be on April Fool's Day. Like, right, really? I mean, it's just like so funny, right? Of course, because of all the things that could be weird if it was an April Fool's joke would be the fact that maybe, hey, someone walks in and says, hey, he's risen from the dead. And then you go, April Fool's, you know, and it would just be like so weird, right? You can imagine the gals coming back from the tomb. You know, and they come back and tell the disciples in the upper room, hey, you guys, it's empty. April Fools. And then the rest of the disciples, that's not funny. That's not funny. I loved him. We deserted him and we abandoned him. We betrayed him. And you come in here telling us jokes. It's not funny. I think it would have, it's just one of those odd things today, right? So really, here we're here this morning to say he's alive and it's no joke. And it's not a joke. It's real, yeah. Can you imagine what that would have been like? In fact, even on Friday, we kind of highlighted this. Christ gave himself as a ransom for all the world at the perfect time. Can you imagine how incredible that would have been that morning? And guess what? It doesn't have to be any less incredible this morning. The reality that he has risen from the dead. 2,000 years later, he has risen from the dead. And we're going to talk a little bit about that this morning. But let me just kind of, you know, we think about that day. We tell the story, and we don't want to just come here this morning and kind of retell the story. We want to engage the story. We want to embrace it, all right? So, but on that morning, in Matthew 28, there's just a bunch of things that happened on that morning. First of all, the two Marys went to the tomb, right? They did. They went when it was still dark, so that at sunrise, when they were free to do some things after Passover had finished, they go to the tomb, and it's empty. And they are amazed, they're confused, they don't know what to do about it. And right as they were going, it seems as if an earthquake had happened, and it says that an angel had rolled away the tomb. These are all supernatural things that happen. And the earth, and the stones rolled back. It says that the Roman guard who had been placed there were literally scared to death. They had fainted on their job, which would be a death sentence for a Roman guard, to fall asleep or to be faint. That would be the immediate end of their lives. And then it says that an angel announces to them that Jesus has risen from the dead. And you can almost try to see the wheels moving in their heads, right? Trying to catch up to that thought. It must have been absolutely incredible to them to try to figure all that out. And so it says that the women quickly departed with fear and with great joy to tell the disciples. I like that because it's so human, right? They left really afraid, but also with great joy, and they're running back to this place to tell the disciples in the upper room. That's an amazing thing. And it says, on their way, Jesus greeted them, and they worshiped him. Can't even picture it, right? It just knocks me out. And then it says that this news forced the chief priest to pay the soldiers hush money, because when they came back and they said, hey, look, it's empty. We can't explain it. And they said, hey, look, this is going to get out. People are going to tell stories. We got to get ahead of this story. We got to get on the front end of it. We're going to say that the disciples came and stole the body. And here's, we're going to give you money, hush money, in order to tell that story. Because this is going to kill us. This story is going to really get to us. Okay, so do something about it. And then Jesus appears to them in the upper room. And everything from then is history, right? It's all happened since then. So let me just ask this. Like, what? What has happened? What would it look like to tell that story today? How do we tell that story today? Let me just run through a few things that we use to tell that story. First of all, we use bunnies. We have bunnies that tell the story, right? I don't know how bunnies got into this thing, but we have bunnies. Or if we do better than that, we have chicks, okay? We're going to tell the story of chicks, especially ones that come out of a really nice egg, right? And that's Easter, you know, or at least colored eggs, okay? We're going to get colored eggs, especially the red ones, because they represent kind of the tomb opening up when you break it open, and it represents kind of the blood of Christ, but we've kind of turned it into pastels. It's a pastel egg. Let's get better than that. How about egg hunts? That's a kind of Easter, and here's where we get these massive amount of kids out on fields, football fields, and we hide eggs between grass blades, you know, and there's no real, right? There's no real hiding, and we put kids out on a field, and they trample each other, and then when the slower ones don't get as much, the young ones, they start crying, and happy Easter. We're going to love this thing. So let's move on to something a little bit more Easter, okay? Chocolate. Right? Right? Then we're talking, now we're talking Easter. Now let's get to real Easter. Peeps. Okay, now. Do you know that 1.5 billion peeps will be purchased for Easter this year? That's incredible. And peeps are not very good until you've left them out for 2 weeks and allowed them to get hard. Then they're good. Or how about my favorite is jelly beans? This is Easter, right? Well, let's kind of leave all the silliness behind and let's reach into the way we present Easter in a better way than that. How about this? We have precious Jesus, right? Nice Jesus. He's very safe. This Jesus is very safe. He's nice. I don't know. I don't think that's what he's like. Or what about this one? Your medieval holier-than-thou Jesus. You know, we have this. Somehow he's just kind of in this halo, right? Or this is kind of the one we bought into more recently is the NFL Jesus, right? You know? Can't you see him coming out of the tomb and doing the Heisman, you know? I mean, we've got the NFL Jesus going here, okay? And so is that what it's all about? Is that what's going on here? So I want to ask the question, what should it look like today? Today, 21st century, what should it look like today? And I think what I want to talk about here is in the book of Acts, oddly enough, in the book of Acts of chapter 17, verses 16 to 34. I want to look at what it says because I think what's going on in this particular chapter is exactly what's going on in our culture right now as we tell this story, okay? So if you have your Bible, go there. If you don't, it's going to be up here, so it doesn't really matter, right? So here we are. We're going to spend time in Acts. And verse 16, we're going to start with, it says, now while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, well, who was he waiting for? Well, he was waiting for Timothy and for Silas, two of his traveling companions. He's on his second missionary journey, and he's gone into Greece. He's gone to Philippi, where things didn't go so well. He got arrested and thrown in jail, and eventually there was enough turmoil in the city that the new believers there came to Paul and said, Paul, you need to leave town for your own sake and for ours. Please, would you move on? And so he moves on to Thessalonica, where things begin to happen too, and then to Berea. But eventually, he tells his two traveling companions, Timothy and Silas, to stay there, and he moves on to Athens alone. A very odd thing for Paul to do. He hardly ever traveled alone, hardly ever did the ministry by himself, but he went to Athens, and he was going to wait for his two companions in Athens. So it says that his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. They had incredible numbers of places to worship. They primarily would worship the 12 Greek gods. There were 12 that were kind of siblings, if you will. And among them are all sorts of them. We'll talk about Athena here in a little while, but Apollos and others. They would be all these gods that they would worship. And there were hundreds of other gods that temples were built to in Athens. It was full of idols, and his spirit was provoked. It bothered him. It tore at him because he knew that there was one God that they didn't know anything about. Look at this in verse 17. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons. So often, almost always, when Paul went to a city, he would find the Jewish synagogue, and he would go there first because he understood there was a unique relationship between God and the Jews. And he would go there and argue from the scriptures that Jesus was the Messiah. And there were also people there that were called here devout persons. These are usually called Gentiles who had a clear understanding that there was one God and he was something unique among what the Jews were talking about. And so he would go and he would speak with them. And he would speak in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Now the marketplace is called the Agora. So you guys, because I love maps and I love history, I want to show you a little bit about Athens. So here's a picture of modern-day Athens. It's a little bit fuzzy because it's pretty far away, but right there in the middle is the Acropolis, but this is all around it. But when we talk about the marketplace or the Agora, let's circle it up here in the left-hand corner. This is where the marketplace was, both the Greek and the Roman marketplace. This is where there were all sorts of religious things to do, but there are also where you would go to buy food and clothing and shoes and whatever. It was the marketplace. And so this is where Paul's hanging out and talking to people about Jesus, with anyone who will talk. Now, let's just get our bearings here. This is a picture of the marketplace today. I couldn't get a first century picture. I must have erased it from my computer, but because I was there once, I'm that old. But this is the marketplace. And you can just imagine thousands of people going here. Frankly, behind that kind of that tower in the middle of the picture there were the latrines. Just so you know, they had their own public latrine area. And then there were other places to worship, and there were places to buy things. Now let's go back to our original map. Here in the middle is the Acropolis. Most of us have heard of that. And let's look at a picture here of the Acropolis. This is where the famous huge temple to Athena, the goddess of wisdom. This is where they worshiped her. And there were others on this whole Acropolis that they worshiped also. And then over here to the left is going to be a place we're going to hang out, back on the other picture. Over here is the Areopagus, or what we call Mars Hill. Okay, now this is a place where the philosophers and the thinkers of their day would come to discuss and to debate, to hear each other. And we'll hear a little bit more about that here just in a minute. And this is what the Areopagus looks like from the Acropolis, looking down onto it. It's this big rock. And that's kind of what it means, is to be on this big rock, to be able to discuss things. Now, if we look back from the Areopagus to the Acropolis, this is what it looked like looking up. And you can imagine how majestic that looked when you're standing there talking about the deep things of life, and you look up onto this plateau, and all these beautiful temples were up there to all these gods. Wow. Now, well, let's go on in Acts 17. So in verse 18, we get this. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. Now, you guys, well, who are these guys, the Epicureans and Stoics? We could spend a lot of time talking about it. But just so you know, both of them believed that there either wasn't a God, or that the God that came kind of set the world in motion and now has stepped back and has nothing to do with it. And so they had begun to reject all these Greek gods that were kind of a mixture of man and divine, in a very strange kind of a way. They had begun to reject that and begin to focus far more on man. So the Epicureans really didn't believe there was any clear structure to life. But the biggest value in life was to live for happiness. It wasn't hedonism, the way we would think of hedonism today. It was kind of a modest hedonism. But you would at least search for happiness. And that a modest way of living life was probably the best way to find happiness. But being happy was the key, and it was man's own devices from which you found happiness. And so that's what the Epicureans would speak about. The Stoics were far more committed to thinking that I don't think there's a God, but if there is, he's probably not present in our presence here. And the Stoics believed in a very structured piece of life, that life made sense and fit together, and that your job as a human being was to figure out how it fit together and how to make sense of it, and that virtue was the highest value of man. Now, the problem was that each individual would come up with their own system of virtue. We would hope that those virtuous systems would cooperate, but we know the reality is that sometimes our own made-up systems of virtue collide with each other. And there was never a real peace about the whole thing. But here the Epicureans and the Stoic philosophers would converse with him, and they'd say, "What does this babbler wish to say? What is this kind of crazy guy saying?" And others would say, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign deities. We've never heard these things before." Because he was preaching, and I want to circle it. Here's what he preached, was Jesus and the resurrection. You see, this thing that we're recognizing today, the resurrection of Christ, is a critical piece of what it means to believe in Jesus. We believe that he resurrected from the dead. Now, you guys, can I explain it? Only by the power of God could someone be resurrected from the dead. We know that some people resuscitate within a few hours of being clinically dead. We know that's been true. It's happened numerous times. But no one is resurrected from death after 3 days. But that's what he's preaching. Well, let's go on and look at this. It says, look at this, in verse 19. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, right? They're taking him to that rock spot over there. And he's saying, hey, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting. For you bring some strange things to our ears, and we wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. So at least they were open-minded, right? This is a place in the Areopagus where they begin to exchange ideas and wrestle with what they're saying. Verse 21, now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. You guys, I'm just not so sure that what was happening in Athens isn't a lot like our world today and our culture today. That we seek happiness like the Epicureans. That we seek meaning based on our own thinking and own value systems like the Stoics. And that sometimes we get very caught up with exchanging ideas and hearing something new, but having it mean nothing to our lives. It doesn't change anything. And so in verse 22, it says, so Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, says, and you can almost see, almost feel him taking a deep breath, swallowing deeply, and saying, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious, right? You just have to look up from the Areopagus and look at the Acropolis. All you have to do is look around. For as I was passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. They wanted to make sure their bases were covered, right? I mean, we've got all these gods going, but what if we missed one? You guys, we don't know for sure, but look at this. This is a piece of a temple that in the Greek on the side of it, you can't read it right now because it's worn away. It says, to the unknown God. It means to the agnostic God, the one that we don't know about. An agnostic is someone who says, I'm not sure. I don't know if there's a God or not a God. And this was a temple to saying, if there's one we don't know about, here he is. Now, we don't know if this is a first century piece. It could have been later. But it could have been the one. It could have been what Paul was reading. But let's go back. It says, what therefore you worship as unknown, this I want to proclaim to you. I want to tell you about him. The God who made the world. Now, you guys, try to think through. They saw the gods as kind of an unpredictable set of gods. They were somehow incestuous gods who somehow came up with offspring between themselves. There was even one of the Olympian gods, the 12, that interacted and mated with a mortal. And that's how they came into being. So it's a god, it's a kind of an odd set of gods. But here he says, in verse 24, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth. He didn't just become, he made it all. Wow. Who does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. You see, we have a self-existent God who has no need of you or me. He only desires us. He doesn't need me, but he wants me. It's an amazing thought. And yet we kind of excuse God from our world, don't we? We tell him we don't really need you. But the unfortunate thing is, when we excuse God, we have no basis for morality anymore. If we say, God, we don't need you, we'll make up our own morality, thank you. But then what happens when our moralities collide? Because they do, right? We live in a world of incredible collision of the moral systems of our world. And so without him, there's no direction. Without him, there's no basis for meaning in life. We make up our own meaning. We make it up for ourselves. We hope that it doesn't cause too much trouble. And without God, there is no basis for real hope. We only have hope in hope itself. But hope itself has no substance. But hope in a God who is real. And this is a God who doesn't need to be served by human hands, nor does he need anything, since he himself gives all mankind life and breath and everything. The God who gives you life and breath and everything. Do you know, we can't really explain why the atom doesn't collapse on itself. There's a scientific reason. We just haven't figured it out yet. But do you know who made that scientific reason? Do you want to know the one who got you up this morning, who gives you breath and life? And everything is a God of creation, the self-existent God. Wow. Look at this in verse 26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. You see, God's idea of diversity is he did it. Black and white, brown, this, that, guy, gal. He created this to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place. God knew. Because I don't know exactly how he does it, but your life he knows about. And he has allotted you time and space. I don't know how many years you're going to get. I don't know how many years I'm going to get. But he's already allotted it to me. And he's given me a place to be, a person to be, and an allotted days of my life. God has it in mind. And in verse 27, that they should seek God. And I love this part. It says, and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him. Is that just an interesting, it feels so responsible as a human being to turn my face towards and say, could I search for God? Could I feel it out? Could I figure it out? Could I try to sense, is there a reality of his presence? But look at this, and he says, yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in their own poets said this, in him we live and move and have our being. Understanding that the life we have comes from beyond us. Wow. And even some of their own poets said this, for we are indeed his offspring. He created us. Wow. Well, you guys, if that's true, look at this in verse 29. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think of the divine as being as gold or silver or stone. That's what all their gods were, right? You looked around, it was as gold, silver, and stones. And somehow they were a representative of some sort of impersonal god. But we shouldn't think of him that way, as an image formed by the art and the imagination of man. Wow, I love that thought. In times, the times of ignorance God overlooked, but now, as a result of having revealed himself through his creation, through the reality of our conscience, but also in the reality of Christ, we'll get there, look at this. In times of ignorance, God has overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, to stop, recognize him and who he is, and to turn from the place where I had been going and to head in a new direction, in a better direction, in his direction. That's all repent means. That's what he's done. And here's the reason. Look at this in verse 21. Because he fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. We will face him as judge. At the end of my life, I'm going to look at him face to face. God will call me to account for my life and for yours. He'll call you to account for it. And we will face this world in righteousness by the man that he has appointed. Look at this. And it is this that he has given assurance by, circle it, all by raising him from the dead. You guys, the most incredible evidence that God supplies for his presence is not just creation, but by the resurrection of Christ, who gave himself on a cross, was buried in a tomb, and 3 days later walked out alive, defeating death, not only for himself, but for you and me. He raised him from the dead. This is what Paul's announcing to the Athenians. And I'll tell you what, they are getting blown away. Look at this in verse 32. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some, here's the first response, they mocked him. Literally what this means, circle it, is this is a joke. They're saying, nice joke, Paul. April Fool's, buddy. This is terrible. This stinks. You're out of your mind. You're an idiot. What you're saying, stupid, this is a joke. Wow, and you know what? That feels like the world we live in, doesn't it? People mock you for believing in Christ. Guess what? They mocked Paul. Guess what? They mocked Jesus. Because for some, it doesn't sit right. They don't buy it. They're not buying in. They're not going to do it. But that's not true for everybody. Look at this. But others said, we will hear you again about this. They were intrigued. They were interested. They wanted to hear more. We'll talk with you again, Paul. Come back tomorrow. Meet me for dinner. Can we have lunch together? Can we hit a Starbucks together? Can we talk about this? Because this is new and different, but there's something about it that's real. I don't know about you, but the first time I ever heard the gospel, I was intrigued. Statistics tell us that for someone who comes to Christ, they need to hear the gospel 7 times from different angles to have it make sense. You know what? I think it's true. I think that's what happened in my life. I began to hear it in different ways. I need to hear it again. Can we sit down and talk about it? So some did that. Look at verse 33. He says, so Paul went out from their midst in verse 34, but some men joined him and they believed. They believed what he said. They believed it was true. They were convicted by the Spirit that this was absolutely true. Some mocked. Some said, I'd like to hear you again. Others said, I buy it. And it's interesting here that he writes down a couple of people. You know, would this be like one of the coolest things ever to have your name recorded? You're the ones in Athens. Very few people are buying in. But Dionysus, the Areopagite, and that means he's on the council of the Areopagus. He's like one of the top guys. He's a leader. He's on the board of directors. Dionysus buys it. He goes, man, I believe this. And he buys in and he follows and he says, I'm with you, Paul. I'm with you. You know, it's absolutely free, the gospel. The love of Christ is free. You don't have to pay a thing for it. You could never earn it. You can't be good enough for it. It's a gift. He wants to give it. But somehow Dionysus also understood that it'll cost me my whole life. I'm turning my back on that other stuff, and I'm headed this direction. Coming to Christ changes the reality of your life immensely. Dionysus bought it. And look at this. And a woman named Damaris. Damaris means woman. It means wife. So we don't know if she's Dionysus' wife or if she's just a woman. Not just a woman, you know what I mean? She's not his wife. She's this woman. I love it that it lists her. And you know what? She must have been an incredible gal because women were not allowed on the Areopagus unless you were incredibly bright. This is a gal who could hold her own. And she heard what Paul said, and she said, I buy it. I'm in. And look at this, and others with them. He just didn't list them. So it brings us to kind of ask some questions, and I'm just going to run through these. But I want us to wrestle with these questions. First of all, what do we do with this? Let me ask you, are you looking for that elusive happiness or self-defined virtue apart from God, the God who made us? Trying to find happiness in this world? Or some sort of virtuous way to live, but say, God, I don't want you to be a part of this. You don't connect. But the reality is without him, there is no basis for virtue. There's no basis for morality. There's no basis for meaning. There's no basis for hope. But is that what we pursue? Is that what we've been after? How about this? Do you recognize that God is the one who has allotted your time and your place in life? That God has his hand on you? He has a design for you. He knows the days. He's numbered them for you. And that might be 99, like Billy Graham. And it might be one more day than what you have today. I don't know, but he does. And the reality of that, living in light of eternity, is a critical responsibility that each one of us have. Or another question is this. Is it a priority for you to seek God with all of your faculties, with all of your heart, mind, and strength? Is that a priority for you, to seek him? Can you imagine anything more important than to seeking the God that we sense is really actually there? Wow. How about this? Are you open to repenting? Are you open to turning from your broken systems of life to engage a perfect plan? We all have these dances we do in life, and most of them aren't very good. But we insist on doing them rather than dancing his dance. Are you open to repenting? Do you trust the assurance of a relationship with God based on the resurrection? That Christ defeating death that our sin has brought upon us. He offers forgiveness and freedom. He gave himself on a cross for that, and he rose from the dead for that. Do you trust that assurance? That's what he's offering us. So last question, what do you do with all of this? What do you do with it? I wonder if we're not too much different than those in Athens. The first, you may mock this. You may reject this and say, that's a joke. I don't buy it. That stinks. That's stupid. You're dumb. The whole thing's dumb. Not interested. That they responded that way then, and we can respond that way this way, in our day and age too. But there are others who said, I want to consider this. I want to stop and think about it. I want to interact about it. I want my life to make sense, and I want to see if this has an answer. Those are the people that we need to get with. You know, tell you the truth, the mockers, I want to talk to them too. Because they're people, right? They matter. They're important. They have value. They have thoughts and feelings. They have life just like us. They go through all the ups and downs that you and I go through. Guess what? They're valuable and important. If they mock, I don't care. I want to interact. If they consider, then I want to go there too. Let's talk about the real issues. I got to sit down this week with a gentleman who was really struggling with these issues. And I'll tell you what, it was the best 2 hours of my week. It was an incredible time just to connect and wrestle with the issues, wrestle with the things that God is doing, to consider. And we all still do that, right? So there's the mockers and the considerers, and there's the ones that believe. To say, you know what? I'm putting my faith in him. I buy it. I'm in. And so this morning, I don't know where you're at. God does. That's what matters. If you're if your heart is a place of mocking or is in a place of considering, or maybe you say, you know what, I made this decision a long time ago. Or maybe some of you are saying, I made this decision recently. Or there may be a few of you, there may be a handful of you, maybe a bucket full, maybe a barrel full, maybe a whole section full of people who say, you know what, I've been wrestling with this. Today I believe. Today I'm putting my faith in this one who loved me, the one who made me, the one who designed me, the one who has designed my life, the one who cares for me, the one who I'm willing to surrender my life to. I believe. This might be your day. I don't know. But if it is, take the opportunity. Don't let it slip away. And for those of you who already believe, this is an incredible day to enjoy behind the Berlin Wall of flowers here the incredible love of God as Jesus is risen from the dead, right? He has risen, and he has risen indeed. When someone said it to me this morning, they said, he has risen. I said, man, I heard about it. I heard it, and I know it's happened. It's real, right on. That's incredible. May it rock the world and rock our lives. All right? So let's pray.